How effective was the influenza vaccine a couple years ago?
Preventing stroke during heart surgery.
Can anyone treat hepatitis C?
And screening for nasopharyngeal cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on August 11th, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. This is something that's upcoming, of course. How effective is the flu vaccine that we're going to give very shortly here? We'll have a national campaign to get everybody vaccinated against the flu. What does history tell us about how good that is, especially in children?
Let's remind our listeners that there are two basic types of flu vaccine. One is what's called the live attenuated, and the other is the killed vaccine. The live attenuated is a vaccine in which the flu has been weakened. It's usually administered by a nasal spray. That's opposed to the killed vaccine, which is injected. Well, in the past, the live attenuated, the spray, has been preferred in kids simply because they don't enjoy having a shot. Well, unfortunately, in about 2012, 2013, it became apparent that the nasal spray wasn't effective, especially in children. It was okay in adults, but not in children. So what they decided to do was to reformulate it for the new flu season. That's the basis of this study, is with this reformulation of the nasal live attenuated virus, is it effective or not in children? They took almost 7,000 participants who tested positive for influenza virus and assessed the effectiveness of the vaccine, either the live attenuated or the killed. And what they determined was the injectable form was about 70% effective, but the live attenuated form, the nasal spray, was essentially ineffective. About 10 to 15%, and it was particularly bad in children.
This, of course, is very disconcerting for all of those parents who would prefer not to have their screaming child getting yet one more injection, and we've both had that experience with our own kids. I am wondering why we ever thought a nasal spray was going to be effective to begin with.
Well, Elizabeth, it's interesting. It seems like it was probably effective prior to the 2012-2013 season, but something has happened. And the reason for that is really unclear. There have been studies now in Finland, at least two in the United States, and also the United Kingdom, that have all shown the exact same thing.
Well, having had the experience of having it myself, I would say I thought it was most unpleasant having that stuff dripping down the back of my throat. However, what about this season? Does this say to parents, hey, get your child the vaccine, the injection, even though it's not going to be a pleasant experience?
And in fact, the CDC and the WHO are both recommending that kids get injection and not the nasal spray.
And we'll wait for that patch that we described a few weeks ago to come on the market specifically for this application. Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, let's stay there. We're also talking about viruses still there, the Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, and its relationship to nasopharyngeal cancers.
This is use of what's called a liquid biopsy. We'd like to have markers that detect cancer in its very early stages. These would either be some types of protein or DNA that the cancer cells would slough off into the blood, and if we could measure them, we'd be able to detect cancer in its very early form. Nasopharyngeal cancer is a cancer that's more common in the southeast part of the world and is more likely in individuals who have a history of it and individuals that have had exposure to Epstein-Barr virus. Knowing that these cancer cells may slough off Epstein-Barr virus, can we measure it in asymptomatic individuals to detect nasopharyngeal cancer in high-risk populations? This is a particularly aggressive, fast-growing type of cancer, and oftentimes when we detect it, it is in its later stages, when it's harder to treat and the survival's less. So to address this, the investigators looked at over 20,000 individuals that were considered to be at risk, had no symptoms at all, and they drew blood samples testing for this viral genome particle. If it was detected, they verified it with a second test. Of the 20,000 individuals, there were about 390 that tested positive. And in those individuals, they did a very careful endoscopic examination, and they also did an MRI. And they were able to find that about 10% of them actually had the cancer. It was more likely to be in its very early stages where they could treat it. So when they looked at the three-year progression-free survival, it was about 97%, whereas in this population, historically, it's only about 70%.
liquid biopsy, very attractive, of course, as a target for many, many cancers. But I guess I would ask you, for all of those facts and figures that frequently attend studies like this one, how many do we have to screen? How much does it cost per case detected? What about the long-term benefits of treatment at this early stage versus catching it later and all of that?
Those are all great questions. When you do the analysis, you have to screen about 590 individuals to find one cancer. The cost of that treatment, including the blood test, the endoscopic exam, and the MRI, just $28,000. That compares favorably to what it costs to treat these individuals. So all in all, it looks like this could be a very cost-effective way of finding nasopharyngeal cancer in populations at risk.
There's going to be more about this, I feel absolutely persuaded. Let's turn from here to Annals of Internal Medicine. The idea that, gosh, primary care docs are perfectly empowered to treat people with hepatitis C.
There are approximately 2.7 million individuals in the United States living with hepatitis C. And by the way, only about 50% of them are aware that they have the disease. We've talked over the last several years about direct-acting antiviral agents that are very effective at treating this condition, so that you can get cure rates of 95 to 97%. The unfortunate thing is we only have about 20,000 specialists. That includes either gastroenterologists that know about liver disease or infectious disease individuals that can treat these patients. 2.7 million individuals, 20,000 doctors, the numbers just don't add up. Can we train non-specialists to deliver the right medications over the right period of time to get the same results as specialists would do? So what these investigators did, they went to 13 urban, federally qualified health centers in Washington, D.C., socially, economically deprived individuals. This is the group of individuals that are the hardest to treat. They trained three groups of health providers, primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, and specialists over a three-hour period of how to deliver the proper medications. And then they randomized 600 patients to those three groups. And then at the end of the study, they said how many of these individuals got the proper medicine and treated properly and responded. What they found was that 85 to 90% of the patients treated had a sustained virologic response, regardless of how that was delivered. So this is great news because it shows that in a real-world cohort of patients that we can deliver great care for hepatitis C patients using non-specialists.
It really is excellent news. And of course, we've also learned that they're developing even better tools for eradicating the virus. So sounds to me like this is something that should be promulgated.
Absolutely. And this follows on previous studies that have shown you can use specialists to deliver care via telemedicine using primary care physicians. Now this just extends it to show if you have effective training over a short period of time, again, a three-hour training, you can get excellent results using other healthcare providers.
Very good. Finally, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. When you need to have your aortic valve replaced and devices are placed to try to make sure you don't dispel little fragments into your vasculature, into your blood system, does it help?
Stroke is a major complication of having the aortic valve replaced. These valves are often replaced in individuals that are elderly, average age of about 70 years. They have a lot of calcium on it. Oftentimes, little pieces of debris, either tissue or calcium, or little clots can form. And when the valve is put in and blood flow is restored, the individual can have a stroke. That's the major complication of aortic valve replacement. Could we put devices that would either filter that out or actually vacuum or suck out that debris to prevent strokes in people having aortic valve replacement? And we have at least two different types of these devices. We call them cerebral embolic protection devices. Both of them were tested in individuals who are having aortic valve replacement and compared to individuals that had none of these devices placed. They followed these individuals to see whether they had evidence of a stroke, MRI changes indicating there may have been a stroke, even if there weren't symptoms, and then studying other side effects or complications. Unfortunately, what they found was that the cerebral embolic devices really did not prevent strokes, MRI changes, and they were more likely to be associated with things like acute kidney injury or cardiac arrhythmias.
It is unfortunate, but still suggests. So what about the rate of stroke in these folks? What was that?
the rate of stroke was about 8%. Now, the rate of changes in the MRI was really much higher, and that is, it looked like two-thirds of individuals had some type of what I'm going to call mini strokes, although by doing neurocognitive testing, there really wasn't any significant change. There was one interesting thing. The individuals that had the devices had about half the rate of having delirium 1 week after the surgery. One of the things that the authors suggested was maybe preventing delirium can help prevent dementia down the road or some of the long-term cognitive changes. That's a hypothesis. It's not proven. It would require an additional study for a longer period of time.
Sounds to me like it's back to the drawing board, though, with regard to protection and trying to avoid a stroke subsequent to surgery.
Right. I agree with you. Anything we can do to decrease the risk would be desirable. Unfortunately, these devices don't appear to be the answer.
On that note, I'm going to discuss the influenza vaccine this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.